This is KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna, listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. I'm Ashlyn O'Hara, and this is the Kenai Conversation. On today's episode of the Kenai Conversation, we are airing part of a gubernatorial forum organized by the Kenai and Soldotna Chambers of Commerce. This debate was held at the Soldotna Regional Sports Complex on August 6. It included 10 of the 17 candidates for Alaska governor. After an open forum, attendees voted for their top five candidates: Adam Crum, Dave Bronson, Matt Halala, Shelley Hughes, and Maida DeWitt, to advance to a debate, which we'll hear now.
And I'll turn it over to Rebecca for our first question, and that is going to go to Shelley Hughes.
Okay, here we go. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game Commissioner Doug Vincent Lang has said bycatch does not explain the scale of Alaska's king salmon losses. First of all, do you agree? And whether you do or not, what specific action would your administration take to address declining king salmon returns to the state?
Thank you for the question. Bycatch is part of the problem, but it's definitely not the sole problem. And so looking at the water temperatures, fish habitat, there are many things that could be done. But I will tell you this. Our fish and game is like a PFD to us. Many of us live here because of that. When I first moved to Alaska, we were pretty much living off of fishing and hunting, growing our own food. And that's an important thing. So the commissioner's main thing is to manage for abundance and get out of the politics, get out of the litigation, let the attorney general do that. Let my running mate, former retired General Blake Geddes, get on that. Fish is a very tough thing. King salmon is part of our culture, and we have to start solving it. And we have to understand it's not going to be put all our eggs in one basket. It's got to be an approach from all sides to restore the fish, and we're going to have to work hard.
Thank you. All right, next candidate, Dave Bronson.
Great. Well, Doug's a great guy. I know him personally. He has said that, but he's also said this. He says, we don't know what's causing the overall fish decline in this state or the king salmon decline, but he says all we know is it's not trawling. To me, that seems a little bit simplistic. I don't think that's right for too long. Sport fishermen, subsistence fishermen, and personal use fishermen have been having their catches reduced, having their fishing seasons limited, and yet the large factory trawlers who leave relatively little money in our state, they keep taking their money back to Seattle and Tacoma, and they're not restricted. And that's got to change. If we're going to wind this fishery down, we're going to do it together, and they've got to share in this. The governor swears an oath to the Constitution, which includes Article 8, Sections 2, 3, and 4. Like Shelley says, you will manage for abundance, you will manage for the people, and you will manage for sustainability. That's what I will do. I've made the commitment to end trawling within the three-mile jurisdiction that is under the governor's authority.
Thank you. And next, Matt Halala.
Nice. So I grew up in the Kenai River. I come from the commercial fishery also, but I was a skipper in Bristol Bay from the time I was 18 till I was 25. And I've spent a lot of time studying this topic. The trawling industry, that kind of gear is the only gear you can capture the bounty that is in the ocean, that the human mind has a really difficult time grasping. Billions and billions of pounds of pollock, okay? The world needs this product. The country needs this product. It cross-subsidizes all of the other fisheries. It's critically important. Bans are foolish right now because we don't know enough. We know for sure it's going to harm families, and it's going to harm all of our fishery. If you lose the commercial fishery, you lose the runs, because that's how you manage the runs, is through the commercial fishery. I know that through my study, through my background, and we need leaders that are not running with the crowd, getting in bed with the people that want to shut down industry in Alaska. They're the same people.
And that's time. Thank you. And this next question, or the question now, goes to Adam Crum.
And as we repeat the question for our listeners in the radio, the question is, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game Commissioner Doug Vincent Lang has said bycatch does not explain the scale of Alaska's king salmon losses. First, do you agree? And whether you do or not, what specific action would your administration take to address declining king salmon returns in the state? Adam Crum.
I see you guys like to take the light and easy questions here. I would agree that bycatch is not the end-all, be-all. But I also think that families have already felt the pain. For 7 years, the Yukon River has been shut down for king salmon fishing. We have generations of culture that is being erased there. I grew up in Anchor Point, fished on the Anchor River. We haven't had a substantial king salmon run there in over 20 years. The pain has already been felt. But we actually, amongst our abundance principle, I also believe we actually have to share the abundance. We also have to share the pain. And we haven't done that equally amongst parties. We have to do the things that we can control. I have also said on the record that I would also sign a bill that actually restricted trawling within state waters. Because you can't go to the federal government and those fishery councils and demand change unless you are willing to address it in your own backyard. So Alaska, we have got to actually do some of the things we can. There's a lot we don't know about the ocean. But I do know that salmon is important, and Alaska is known for its salmon, not its fish sticks.
Thank you, Adam. And lastly, to Ms. Mita DeWitt.
Thank you very much. Man, the juiciest political topic of the century are salmon, especially king salmon. It is a multiple segment issue that we have to address. Yes, trawling is part of it, but not all trawling is the same. So the bycatch, you know, many of us were in Unalaska and got to see their process and how they're regulating and reducing and working to eliminate bycatch completely. But what we've also found when we dig into the issue is in the Prince William Sound, so a lot of these salmon, they'll travel down to the shelf in the Pacific Ocean and feed and then travel back up. So there are trawlers who have rollers who scrape the bottom of the ocean in the Prince William Sound, and it's killing the availability for nutrients. So it's not just that they're pulling fish up, it's that the habitat is actually being destroyed in the ocean floor. So working with the governor, can't shut down all trawling, but the governor does have things that they can do.
That's time. Thank you. All right. Thank you, candidates. The next question. If faced with a budget shortfall, what programs or spending would you be willing to reduce, and what would you refuse to cut? We'll start with Ms. Mita DeWitt. I'll repeat that question one more time. If faced with a budget shortfall, what programs or spending would you be willing to reduce, and what would you refuse to cut? Whenever you're ready.
I would absolutely cut the corporate welfare and the money that we're giving away to oil and gas development, because that money actually belongs to the people. It is maximum development for the people, and that means that the taxes and royalties have to come into the coffer for the people. I absolutely would not cut education and the things that we need to take care of our children and to make sure that they have safe lives, the abundant lives, and that they are cared for, and that we have adequate health care. And we also need to bring in VPSOs into the community. We have 85 communities have no safety officers whatsoever. So public health and safety are mandate with education. Giving away money to outside billionaires, it's off the table, no problem.
Thank you, Mr. Whip. Next, down to Adam Crum, same question to you. If faced with a budget shortfall, what programs or spending would you be willing to reduce, and what would you refuse to cut? Whenever you're ready.
Give me a second. All right, it's stable. Okay. Again, you guys, with the fun questions, just right out the gate. So in Alaska, we could actually reduce the 13 smallest agencies. That's only $1.3 billion. So there's not a lot of room to cut. Governor Dunleavy in 2019 put forward an austere budget, cutting everybody's sacred cow. You know who was upset? Everybody. And so we actually have to take a very real, honest look about where we're at if we face such a budget deficit. What we do know is that fraud, waste, and abuse within the health department is about 20 to 30%. I know because I oversaw that. The problem was we could not address that because during COVID, the federal government expanded enhanced eligibility requirements for all public benefits programs in continuous enrollment, and you could not actually clear the rolls. So that is stuff that we can actually address. And the thing that I would absolutely not cut would actually be transportation in our STIP. It is a 90-10 match. That means for one dime, we get 90 cents from the feds. We have to fix our roads.
Thank you. And now from Mr. Crum, over to Matt Halala. So we will be facing a budgetary shortfall. We have been for many years. And that's because we've lost sight of the vision of prosperity and how we get there. As a manager in business, you first have to gain information. So from day one, it's going to be a severe fiscal transparency effort. And that's where you gain some insight. The most target-rich environment for cuts, because you're going to find waste and abuse, possibly fraud, is within Medicaid. The Medicaid expansion was a big, unsustainable fiasco. major problem, huge amount of fraud, not just from the provider side, but all kinds of things. His tendrils go deep. So that's where I would suspect I would find immediate cost savings there. Public safety and the STIP, the capital expenditure projects, because that's where our economic expansion is going to be derived, is transportation infrastructure and capital expenditures. Thank you, Matt.
And then over to Mr. Dave Bronson. I'll repeat the question again for those listening on the radio. If faced with a budget shortfall, what programs or spending would you be willing to reduce, and what would you refuse to cut?
Well, first off, I wouldn't cut those things that are that we are constitutionally required to fund, which is education included in public safety, the National Guard, those kinds of things. We're required management of our fisheries. We have to do that. A lot of the folks up here are right. If you look at our budget right now, there's not much left to cut. And coming from a fiscal conservative, as a mayor who cut a lot of budgets in the I provided three flat budgets in the city of Anchorage, and this is tough. You've got to audit, and I audited all of our departments. You got to find out where the waste is before you talk about what you're going to cut. And there is fraud, especially in the homeless industry. There is fraud in Medicaid. We know that. That's what we got to get to. So for me to sit there and say what I'm going to cut, I'm not going to say that. I will tell you what I'm not going to cut. And those are the things that the Constitution compels us to fund.
Just to follow up there, Mr. Bronson, I hear you saying that there are things that you would not cut. Are there things that you would consider reducing? So not necessarily cutting
public education. We're going to have this ongoing debate about the BSA forever. It's the debate coming now is BSA possibly against a defined benefit plan. BSA versus something other things. At the end of the day, you can't give these answers until you know where the money is and where it isn't. I'll give you an example as well.
Okay, and then lastly, Ms. Hughes, on to you. Shelley Hughes, next question or next answer.
We are going to showcase in my administration the spending that is mandatory versus discretionary. So you as the public will understand that. The legislature will switch that out, but it's important for you to know. We'll establish a sunset audit commission made up of people from the private sector who know how to run a lean, mean machine. But instead of a report that collects dust on a shelf, their recommendations will go into a piece of legislation, which must go through the legislature if that agency is going to stay. If the legislature doesn't take it up, it will sunset. But in that audit, they will be looking for fraud, waste, and abuse, which is estimated in our state based on our overall budget, somewhere between $500 million and $1.5 billion. There are things that we can cut. The slush fund of unfilled position is an example. All the furniture spending that happens at the end of the fiscal year, we're the highest place in the nation buying furniture. Use it or lose it. We're going to change that.
And that's time.
You're listening to KDLL 91.9 FM, listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. This is the Kenai Conversation. On today's episode of the Kenai Conversation, we're airing part of a gubernatorial forum organized by the Kenai and Soldotna Chambers of Commerce. This debate was held at the Soldotna Regional Sports Complex on August 6th. It included 10 of the 17 candidates for Alaska governor.
Okay, next question. And who are we starting with?
Ms. Hughes.
Oh, Ms. Hughes, that's right. Okay. So the proposed Alaska LNG project has been at the forefront of state politics for months now. There is no question that a gas line would be an economic boon for Alaska, but the questions have centered on the taxation of project developers and a deal that benefits the state. Can you name any specific developer terms for this project that, if you were governor, you would deem unacceptable? I would deem unacceptable virtually doubling what is needed in order to make it economic. So initially it was to reduce, I believe it was about $800 million during the construction phase. And then the legislators who are resisting and slowing this down, they wanted to add and get another $800 million. So that's doubling it. That is not acceptable. We have to make this work. And if it doesn't work, and I will say we're in a time crunch because of the pipelines being built to the British Columbia shore. And if we don't get it built quick, they'll beat us out. But you know what? There are projects on the North Slope where the oil can be put on tankers directly. There are two companies already looking at that.
and they already have the investment lined up. They just need the permits. It will complement, won't compete, and we need to look at that as well. And natural gas is key to achieving low-cost energy, and I would be in their offices every day talking to them. That's what I would do.
All right. Oh, and next to Dave Bronson.
Well, I think it's pretty clear here is that the natural gas pipeline has got to be built. It's absolutely critical to our economy and to our future, to getting our kids to come back to this state. But even as we do that, we've got to make sure we don't sign agreements that exclude the basin, Cook Inlet natural gas. There's 19 trillion out there. There's three trillion cubic feet that are known. In the meantime, we've got to keep drilling out there and incentivizing drilling. And if we keep the producers from the basin from selling to NSTAR, we've created a disaster for ourselves. So think of this. We build a great big long gas line across Alaska, and I'm always thinking as a military man, what is the threat to that? And with the drone technology in this day and age, you could take it with two drones, you could take out a gas line and an oil pipeline in one day. And we need that Cook Inlet natural gas indefinitely to keep supplying us. Otherwise, in the winter, we could be in really big trouble.
All right. And now, Matt Halala.
And let's just repeat the question. So it's a long question. The proposed Alaska LNG project has been at the forefront of state politics for months now. There is no question that gas line would be an economic boon for Alaska, but questions have centered on the taxation of project developers and a deal that benefits the state. Can you name any specific developer terms for the project that if you were governor, you would deem unacceptable?
So right now, I am unaware of any particularly credible items that are absolutely off the table that are being proposed by the developer. As a lifelong negotiator in business, you have to be very cautious to make declarations of what you're willing or not willing to negotiate on. I think that this project is so important for the prosperity of Alaska that I love the statement that cheap and abundant energy is the fertile soil for the seeds of industry. And that's very true. At upfront, the cost of gas may be a little higher than other sources, but if you're looking at the static analysis, but the reality is when you have cheap, abundant energy, industry arrives, you have more buyers, that cost of energy goes down. A lot of great things happen when you can provide cheap and abundant energy. Sometimes there's no exact answers. There's just compromises in negotiation.
Just a quick follow-up on that. Can you identify perhaps a point at which, if you were the governor during negotiations, that you would say, this is too much and I think we need to walk away? We'll give you 30 seconds.
Yeah, I would say that in particular what raises my antenna would be the obligation of the state to buy out the developer if it becomes uneconomic or they go into default, et cetera, the project starts to fail, that we have a disequitable obligation to buy them out at any kind of a sweetheart deal.
Thank you. All right. And then over to Adam Crum, same question.
To specifically answer it about what terms are unacceptable, it's that. That is that the state owes nothing if the project developer walks away. We've got over $1 billion invested in this between project permitting and other dollars. That money's been spent. It is our gas. On the other side, though, as a business owner, as I've been in Wall Street, I have cut deals, I've negotiated these things. It is very, very important that all Alaskans understand that gas is not oil. You can make natural gas from oil. There's so much in it. The value of that is completely different. When you heard some complaints from the legislatures, we're going to lose $8 billion over 30 years. The total amount collected from oil in last fiscal year, all property tax, all royalties, everything, was over $4 billion. So the value proposition we're talking about is not entirely the same. We need the gas to keep the lights on, to innovate and innovate our entire economy. So the most important thing is for us to find a way to build the line, or we're arguing about a piece of pie that does not exist. And so doesn't matter what we get out of that. We have to make sure the line gets built so we're serving you as Alaskans.
And then Mita DeWitt. And Rebecca, the question just one more time. For Mita and for those listening.
Absolutely. The proposed Alaska LNG project has been at the forefront of state politics for months now. There is no question that a gas line would be an economic boon for Alaska, but questions have centered on the taxation of project developers and a deal that benefits the state. Can you name any specific developer term for this project that if you were governor, you would deem unacceptable?
Yes, thank you. So right now there's a battle going on in Juneau, and there's people who are fighting the giveaway. Right now the plan that was presented has no taxation on that pipeline. And in our constitution, it's maximum benefit for Alaskans. That's the guarantee. So that means that it's required to bring money into the coffers to distribute, because you have ownership of and mineral rights that you've given to the state to then create and develop. Also, that plan prioritized exportation over Alaskans, and that is not acceptable. Now, there is an abundant amount of natural gas up in the North Slope. They're just burning it off. It needs to be utilized, but it needs to be done in a way that makes sense and brings dollars into the state and into your pockets.
Thank you, Mita. And now the fourth question. And so, again, we'll just go back in reverse order. So, Mita, you will be answering this question first. And then after that, for everybody, it would be Adam Crum, and then Matt Halala, Dave Bronson, and then Shelley Hughes. So the next question, and Mita, again, this will start with you. Alaska has experienced net out-migration for 13 consecutive years, while its working-age population has begun to decline. Do you consider that a crisis, and what policies would you pursue to help young workers and families build permanent lives here?
It is a crisis. As a business owner, my sweetheart is also a business owner. We have a lack of skilled labor in the state. A lot of people who could leave did leave to other places. One, like we talked about earlier, cost of living has to be addressed. Accessible housing that's healthy and affordable has to be addressed. We also have to address crime rates in our state. We have some of the worst crime rates. And if people can take their kids to get better education other places, they're doing it. We also did a disservice to our public service employees. We do not have a pension for our policemen, our public health nurses, our teachers. We have to support our public servants that actually keep our state running and keep it a community where people want to live and want to raise their family and want to continue forward. We are in a crisis with outward migration. Let's fix it.
Thank you. And now over to Adam Crum, and I'll repeat the question again. It was kind of a mouthful. Alaska has experienced net out migration. We good? Okay. Alaska has experienced net out migration for 13 consecutive years, while its working age population has begun to decline. Do you consider that a crisis? And what policies would you pursue to help young workers and families build permanent lives here?
Yes, that's a crisis. We need to keep our kids here. If we don't have our kids, we don't have a workforce. That means that for our aging population, it is much more difficult to age in place. And everything else gets more and more expensive. Specific things that we can actually lean towards would actually be helping with housing. There would be programs that we need the legislature to approve, including things. If you go to a trade school or college in Alaska, you could actually have some of your debt paid for, or you have access to cheaper home loans through the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. The more likely they are actually to come up here, that's a magnet to attend classes and training in Alaska, but also to build their home here. Simultaneously, we're going to address education. Like I said earlier, we're going to train our workers through CTE. We're going to give them the skills of the future. AI is here. It is coming. It is going to wipe out a lot of white-collar jobs. Let's work with our hands and give them the dignity of work and take advantage of all of these jobs that we have in oil, in gas, in mining, in construction.
Thank you. And now from Adam over to Matt Halala. Same question, sir, whenever you're ready.
Yes, absolutely. It's a crisis. When you're losing your kids, you lose your community. If you don't have an economy, you don't have a community. This is all economic. The gravest danger is we can look at the symptoms of a disease, housing, affordability, all these things. It's a consequence of the primary disease of a lack of the heart of the explorer and the will to come together to get our economy going. We've got to get back to a prosperous time like it was 40 years ago when I was a kid, when there was all kinds of opportunities for high-paid work. That's what it's about. And the grave danger is that we think it's government's job. These opportunities are created in the private sector. The government's obligation is to create a feasible, inviting environment to industry. Thus, that creates the jobs, and it makes a more inviting environment sustainable for our kids, and then the out-migration problem is solved.
Thank you. And now to Mr. Dave Bronson. Same question. I'll repeat it one more time for the listeners on the radio. Alaska has experienced net outmigration for 13 consecutive years, while its working age population has begun to decline. Do you consider that a crisis, and what policies would you pursue to help young workers and families build permanent lives here?
Well, it most certainly is a crisis, and I dealt with it extensively in the city of Anchorage, which population is declining greater than the population is statewide. Let me give an anecdote, a little story here. I had a corporation came up to me, major corporation. I won't name it. You'll all know it. They says, we got 47 executive positions, high six-figure jobs that are coming to Anchorage. I talked to him a few months later. I says, did they come up? And he says, no, all but two refused. And I says, well, what's going on? They said the quality of education. Our people came up, they looked at the quality of education in the Anchorage area, and they says, we're not putting our kids in it. So let's go back now to the very first question an hour ago was, what is the first thing that you're going to do? You can't do one thing, you got to do everything. You can't tax the oil companies that pay us. You can't abuse them the way we've been abusing Hillport. You just can't. We've got to make our education system better. Every mayor in this room understands you got about 10 or 12 things going on at one time that are big, and this is what's causing the problem.
Thank you. And finally, same question to you, Ms. Shelley Hughes.
Thank you. This is the very issue that tipped the scale for me to run, and when I went to my family and my husband and I said, the state needs my skill set, because in 10 years, fast forward, you don't have a state. You don't have a society if our young working families are leaving. It's an affordability crisis, and that is how I built the whole foundation of my platform. Look at my website. It's more comprehensive than any other candidate because I want feasible steps, an action plan that you can see that will start solving the decades-old problems that have been around, achieving low-cost energy through a portfolio discussed earlier. Getting lands into private hands, both state lands and federal lands, and building the infrastructure that we need in order to support the economy. That's what we have to do, and we don't have any time to waste. We've got to put a Republican forward who actually can win and get to work.
Thank you. All right. Next question.
Well, our next question has been answered by a lot of the comments that we just heard, so I'm going to suggest that we move on to the specific questions and then come back after those if we have time to have other questions.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Okay, so the first question is going to be for...
I'll just quickly specify that this next round of questions for everybody, while the candidates have received the same question through each round here, these will be candidate-specific questions. So each candidate will have a different question, and it will be specific to them as a candidate. Go ahead.
Okay, so since we just ended with Shelley, we will start with her. You have extensive experience in the legislature, but the governor's role requires managing state agencies, executing policy, and making decisions with limited time and information. What experiences have best prepared you to lead the executive branch, and how would your leadership style differ from your approach as a legislator?
Thank you. It's a really good question. So I spent more than 30 years in the private sector and raising a family, so I have a broad array of organization management skills in my work for major projects. So I bring that to the table, but I'm going to take this opportunity also to highlight my running mate, retired General Blake Geddes, Air Force. He's overqualified. He could run for governor. And out of all the running mates, he's the most qualified. And if another candidate had him, I'd be jealous. So part of what I'm going to do, Rebecca, is with all the work that we have, I'm going to use my lieutenant governor in a way that has not happened since statehood. He is going to be given some of the tasks to lead on his own, and I'm fine with sharing the limelight with him because it's important that we have the leadership in order. There's many things to tackle, and with his help, we'll be able to do a lot more. It'll be a two-for-one. You're going to have two people working for you.
And that's your time. Apologies. Thank you. All right, and now to Mr. Dave Bronson, your question. As mayor of Anchorage, your administration had a highly contentious relationship with the Anchorage Assembly. Critics say that conflict made it harder to govern effectively. What would you do differently as governor to build productive relationships with a legislature that may not always share your views?
Well, I had a 9-3 majority against me, and I'm sorry, but the 9-3 majority aren't the majority that's there now. These were different people, and they were quite radical, quite woke. and quite, I would say, confrontational. I'm attacked by the right for my time as mayor for not fighting enough. I'm attacked by the left for fighting too much. I sued them once and won. That's because they tried to take executive privilege away. But at the end of the day, we got a lot of things done. I got the largest appropriation in the history of the state for the Port of Alaska, the Don Young Port of Alaska. We got that done. We got a lot of things done, especially in the area of homelessness. I look forward to working in a legislature in June. That's roughly 50-50 Republican and Democrat. That's a dream come true for me from what I put up with for 3 years. I'm not going to compromise my conservative principles. I'm going to fight where needed, but I'm going to go down there and work with people, and I am going to work across the aisle. I'm not the guy that's going to scream at people. Thank you. And now Matt Halala.
Okay. Matt, you have positioned yourself as an outsider who can change the way government operates. What is one thing you believe Alaska's political establishment has gotten wrong, and what would you do differently?
Well, number one, most important, is I, as governor, will be present in person. That's critically important, and that gives you an opportunity to create and maintain relationships, and then you can become more persuasive. So being present in person, creating and maintaining relationships. And you have to engage. It's very interesting. One of the most controversial, contentious segments of our state right now is education. And the Alaska Superintendents Association had a forum. We were all invited. And a lot of the Republicans decided, you know what? I'm not going to get their vote. You know, we have an obligation to engage. Lisa McGuire and I were the only ones among this contingency that were down there. You have to engage. And you know what? I must say, they were very inviting. I even told them that public pensions were a big disaster. I explained it to them. I said 401ks are where it's at. It's greater mobility, more money in the pocket of retirees without all the obligations. Engagement.
Thank you. And now over to Mr. Adam Cron. Got your mic? Okay. And your question is, you have helped manage Alaska's finances during some of the state's most challenging fiscal years. What is the single hardest decision you would be willing to make as governor, one that may disappoint some voters, but that you believe is necessary for Alaska's long-term future?
Excellent question. I've already done it. I would invest, and I would diversify the state's finances. When I was revenue commissioner, I made the decision to look at our savings account that was making less money than a high-yield checking account and said, that is not acceptable. We are failing Alaskans. And so I actually examined, did due diligence, talked with six of the largest firms in the world, and came up with a plan to actually diversify Alaska's finances to put it into infrastructure. Because what have we talked about all night from every candidate? What does Alaska need? It is infrastructure. And these aren't the ability to actually invest in the state. It's go make money elsewhere. But you're going to use your expertise to actually tell us, how do we make investment-grade projects in Alaska? I was at the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. I was the vice chair. I could not get the votes together to actually increase our risk profile, because we're just a little too tentative right there. Because the reality is, we are the richest poor state you could ever imagine. We have all the money in the bank, but our cash flow is iffy. Well, right now, let's increase our cash flow via investments and risk.
Thank you. And Mita DeWitt.
I feel like I'm being picked on.
Thank you. Okay, Mita, you became well known for leading the effort to recall Governor Dunleavy. Some Alaskans saw that as necessary accountability, while others viewed it as a divisive political effort. What did you learn from that experience, and how would you unite a state with such differing viewpoints?
Thank you. Yeah, I was a statewide organizer and grassroots organizing in the beginning. But what happened was actually it was a coalition of people that came together. It was a coalition of people across the spectrum in different political parties. And we did things that no other movement has done. It was the largest grassroots movement in the history of the state of Alaska. Alaskans were the ones collecting signatures. When you see these other ballots, they pay people to collect signatures. So these were collected by the people standing up to protect their homes from the first budget cuts. If anybody remembers how bad that was, it was absolutely terrible. We have seen an austerity plan since then. But we made our stand and said that we will not tolerate that other kind of behavior in that extreme. So it does take effort to work with people across aisles and actually listen and get things done. I have a proven track record of being able to do that. And we also ended it because it was the best thing to do with COVID.
Thank you. Well, for a moment here, I'll just take a second to say, Rebecca and I were meeting before the event today, and we were trying to narrow down a vast list of questions that we had put together, because our biggest fear was that we would run out of time and that we wouldn't be able to ask the questions that we wanted to ask. So we tried to narrow that list down, and I want to thank these candidates not only for being eloquent, but also for being kind and respectful to one another. We had made room and time for people pointing some fingers here and there. You always have to anticipate that when you're dealing with a political debate. But it has been very civil up here, and as a result, we have a lot of time for more questions. And so this is going to give Rebecca and I an opportunity to dive into that list that we kind of had to pare down. And so we'll kind of just go back and forth, and we'll in that same order, we'll start with you, Mita, and we'll work our way back through, and we'll just ask questions that we actually kind of eliminated from the list. So I'm very happy that we get to ask some of these. And I'll go ahead and I'll start, Rebecca. And the question that I would like to ask, Mita, Alaska already has a Division of Agriculture. Governor Dunleavy proposed creating a cabinet-level Department of Agriculture, but the legislature rejected it, and later a Superior Court judge ruled his executive order to create one unlawful. Does Alaska agriculture need its own department, or should funding and authority be strengthened within the existing structure? Please explain the practical benefit.
How do you mess up a Department of Agriculture? I mean, come on. Sorry. That's a pet peeve of mine. So Alaska, as you may know, is 20% of the United States landmass. We also have a rapidly changing climate. If you've been here for any amount of time, you know that our growing season has extended by 2 months. In the 1950s, Alaska had the majority of the food produced or caught or hunted or grown or gathered here. And we're very self-sufficient. As I said earlier, right now, we ship in 95% of our food and goods. We are not as independent as we believe ourselves to be. So we do need to actually put money into agriculture and work with the legislatures to create the best vehicle possible and also support the food production that already exists in the state and create industry and mom and pops and their own businesses. Again, creating economics that stay here in the state. Thank you.
Rebecca, I'll turn it over here. I'll let you kind of make the decision. Do you want to just continue this question on through the rest, or would you like to ask a different one?
Let everybody answer that question.
All right, let's continue that question on.
I'm not giving up the microphone.
Adam, I'll rephrase it again because it was a lengthy question. Alaska already has a Division of Agriculture. Governor Dunleavy proposed creating a cabinet-level Department of Agriculture, but the legislature rejected it, and later a Superior Court judge ruled his executive order to create one unlawful. Does Alaska agriculture need its own department, or should funding and authority be strengthened within the existing structure? Explain the practical benefit.
Absolutely, we need a Department of Agriculture. There is a misnomer out there that growing government is bad. It is, but also bad governance that is unwieldy is costly. It wastes money, and there's opportunity cost in that. By not having a Department of Agriculture that we can move over the Division of Forestry as well, we are leaving money on the table with the USDA. There are specific grants and time and focus that is out there for farmers, for veterans programs to get into farming, for education programs, money that is available to us. We are the only state in the country without a Department of Agriculture. I was in the governor's office during COVID when we got a call from Governor of Washington and said, I'm going to shut down Pier 5. And that is where all of our goods come from. That was a terrifying moment to realize we absolutely need to focus. How do we build this out? How do we strengthen what we have? And by actually moving the forestry, you can get time and attention through focused sales, actually make money off our trees, and develop more ag land over time.
Thank you. And over to you, Mr. Matt Halala. Same question, sir.
Yeah. So I think most of us agree that government is not right-sized. I think like any organization, organizational entropy and bloat is what's occurred dramatically in government. So, you know, I hear a lot of candidates talking about, hey, I'm going to divide this department into two departments, we are not adding things. We're going to work with what we have. My ethos is elegance is simplicity. By increasing the population head in government through divisions, departments, you're increasing noise. We're looking for signal. We want clarity and simplicity. So there's a lot of opportunity. I am happy that the fishermen are now eligible for a lot of loans and things, opportunities that farmers are now nationally here in Alaska. So that's a great benefit, but creating another department is not a good plan. Thank you.
I think we'll let Adam have a 30-second.
Yeah.
but
yes, absolutely.
30 seconds.
30 seconds. This does not mean adding positions. This means promoting positions. If you actually have hired positions there, it is less time and focus. There's an adage in business. If you want to change something, measure it. We also have to put in the time and focus and make this a cabinet level. Just pull those divisions out, and you elevate into commissioner level the positions that are already there. It's not adding new government. It's adding specific lines of authority.
Thank you. And now same question to you, Mr. Dave Bronson. Would you like me to repeat that one?
Nah, I got it.
Okay.
As an agricultural economics major from the University of Wisconsin, I have a little bit of understanding of this. The short answer is every time you have a problem in life, you don't create a new department. You just don't do that. I'm a conservative. I don't do that. That's how we got into part of this mess in the first place, is we grew government. We grew it under Democrats, and we grew it under Republicans. This is broad-based bad decision-making. As what I will create is an office reporting directly to the governor of agriculture, because you need that one, that single person to come in and give you advice on what the private sector farmers want to do throughout the state. The private sector is the answer to this. It's not. Now, do we support the programs in Delta Junction? Do we support the ag project west of Nenana? Certainly. But those, I just was there a week and a half ago in Nenana and took a tour of the place. That's a good operation, but it's a private enterprise doing it, not government.
Thank you. And then lastly, Ms. Shelley Hughes, same question to you.
I support changing the word division to department, but not spending any more money on it. Government should be responsive to the people. I chaired the Food Security Task Force for 3 years, and I was chosen from the minority. That's very unusual. You usually don't get to chair anything. And what I learned is in Scandinavia, the same latitude as Alaska, a little warmer ocean currents, they export $10 billion in ag products. We import $3 billion. We have room to grow with ag. I have a vision, too. If you watch a video that a press conference I held 2 nights ago, we need to tip up the world and start looking at Alaska from the top. We have the potential to be the transportation hub, intercontinental transportation hub, and our food products would be sought after in other countries as well as throughout the lower 48. We have potential. We need a cabinet-level person.
Okay, and just to follow up on that, to be clear, you said you would keep it essentially the same, but you would just change the name from division to department?
Yes, so the director would become a cabinet member, a commissioner, so they're at the table. We have not had a DNR commissioner. They all admit, that's the Department of Natural Resources, they don't have time for forestry, they don't have time for agriculture, and now we have mariculture, another thing that we would put under that. There's economic growth opportunities with all three of those things, and we need to tap into it. Unless we have that person sitting at the cabinet table, it will not happen.
Thank you. All right, Rebecca.
All right. Let's just take a break from the big questions for a second and some yes-no questions. Raise your hand if you've driven the Dalton Highway. Raise your hand if you've ever ignored someone in a grocery store. Ignored. Walked away from.
You're listening to KDLL 91.9 FM, listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. This is the Kenai Conversation. On today's episode of the Kenai Conversation, we're airing part of a gubernatorial forum organized by the Kenai and Soldotna Chambers of Commerce. This debate was held at the Soldotna Regional Sports Complex on August 6th. It included 10 of the 17 candidates for Alaska governor.
Okay. All right. Next question. Do you believe that private investment is essential to Alaska's future? Why or why not? And what changes would you make to ensure Alaska is viewed as a competitive place to invest?
For a candidate?
Pardon?
Is that a question?
It's for everybody.
For everybody, okay.
For everybody, yeah.
Mrs. Hughes, okay.
Absolutely an essential private investment. We're not going to have state-funded dongles. When I talked about tipping the world, I just want to say the A2A, the Alaska Rail Project, is underway in Alberta, and we need to get on board with that. My legislative history actually worked on each side of the state. I got this successful Senate resolution for the presidential permit for that rail crossing. And then I also brokered the deal to get on the other side of the state, the state funding, $175 million for the Port of Nome. And that project is underway. So we get rail, connect it to the lower 48, bring it to our rail system. We need to have the vision. We're going to be pragmatic, no boondoggles, but we need to have the conversation to start leveraging and seeing if we can get a rail all the way to Nome. And when we do that, we will become the Panama Canal of the 21st century. That is our key to a strong economy for our children and grandchildren. We're going to start working on it. It's going to be private investment.
And now to Mr. Dave Bronson. Same question. Can you repeat it for us, just for the radio listeners as well? Apologies.
Yes. Do you believe that private investment is essential to Alaska's future? Why or why not? And what changes would you make to ensure Alaska is viewed as a competitive place to invest?
Well, right now, first and foremost, Alaska is not a competitive place to invest. Hilcorp. We invite them in to help solve our natural gas problem in the basin here. And then 14 years later, we're checking under the seat cushions for more money, and we go after Hilcorp. And we try to change their tax status from C Corp or from S Corp essentially to C Corp. I'm just telling you, I was dealing with a solar company that looked for months at developing here, not a solar company, but a data center company. And they says after 2.5 months of due diligence, is what they said was, we're not going to invest in Alaska because we think you're going to do to us what you've been doing to Hilcorp. That's private. Hilcorp is private investment. It really is. And all we do is we jam our thumb in their eye and say, well, in the future, it may get real worse for you. We gotta stabilize this. The legislature is actively hostile to capital investment in this state. It really is.
So how about let everybody else answer that, and then we'll have a follow-up question on it.
Okay. All right. So we'll come back to that. Matt Halala, same question to you, sir.
Yeah, that is absolutely foundational. Prosperity occurs in the private sector. The government has a really discrete, defined role in providing an environment with cheap, abundant energy, infrastructure, roads to resources, so that industry can take risk and be a part of our state in creating opportunity for the next generation. So that's so critical. Right now, Governor Abbott, DeSantis, they were down at a symposium. They called it the Boom Belt States. The 11 states, including Texas to Florida and all those in between, they said their primary objective or thing that is their commonality between those 11 states is a low to no tax and stable tax environment, a speedy, reliable regulatory and permitting environment. Those are the two elements that has invited industry to create prosperity. So we have to always remind ourselves our job as a state is to not create the prosperity, but create the environment for prosperity.
Thank you. And then I got myself mixed up here. Sorry. To Adam Crump.
Yep. Yes. We're going to repeat the question. Do you believe that private investment is essential to Alaska's future? Why or why not? And what changes would you make to ensure Alaska is viewed as a competitive place to invest?
I'm just going to hold it. Absolutely, the private sector is key. Government cannot replace the private sector. As I said earlier, there's two primary functions of government: protect property rights and build infrastructure the private sector can't. And what we have in Alaska is a disincentivizing investment environment. I've been on Wall Street. I've had these conversations with banks and projects, and Alaska is considered a backwater. We get in our own way more than anybody can ever imagine. We just had an opportunity to pass a single bill to address one issue, which has to do with oil and gas property tax. The House did that. The Senate got it, and they inserted layer after layer of different things which had nothing to do with the subject that mattered. We have got to figure out what we want to be as a state when we grow up. And absolutely, we need to make it a stable investment environment so people will come up here, they will actually do the money. And then last, I was on the board of ADA. I voted for roads to resources, the West Sioux Road, the Ambler Road. And those are the things that the state puts forward to move Alaska forward.
Thank you. And then over to Ms. Mita DeWitt. Same question to you.
Thank you. Shelley, I'll see your rail and upgrade to high-speed rail. We all know that the Northern Passage is opening up in the Arctic, and that there's a deep water port being put in Nome. There's potentially one going to be put in around Utqiagvik. We have to be able to transport goods across the state in a fast, efficient manner, and especially while we're building up our agriculture. A big part of this is also diversification. We need to diversify our energy sources. Right now, we have communities who are going to be paying upwards of $20 a gallon for heating fuel, if they get it at all. We also have to diversify our energy into renewable and sustainable energy, and of course, a matrix of energy so that we can make sure that it's affordable. And once we have affordable energy, again, like Hilal said, we're going to have increased economic viability. We have to reduce the cost and bring in manufacturing. We have to manufacture here as well.
Thank you.
So just a quick follow-up to you on that. So you do believe that private investment is essential to the
Absolutely,
state?
Yes. And not only private investment. If anybody who's worked in community and putting together packages, there's generally partners that come to the table, and we each bring dollars to the table. So in Yakutat, in the Village Corporation, the corporation brings in dollars, the state brings in dollars, private investment brings in dollars, the feds bring in dollars. And then you have a load where you work together to make it happen, where not one person has the entire risk of their own.
Okay, so then the question for everybody, the follow-up to that, which is just raise your hand.
Radio, we're going to have them say yes or no.
Oh, I was just going to tell the people on the radio that they can watch the whole – they can entire thing on YouTube tomorrow.
All right. Well, let's –
Yes. Okay, so the question is, would you veto a broad-based tax increase if you believed it would discourage private investment in Alaska?
Let's just start at the end. It's just a yes or no.
So just say your name.
Adam, yes.
Yes.
That was Dave Bronson, yes. Shelley Hughes.
Yes.
Yes.
Mita DeWitt and Ben.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
There we go.
All right, so there we go. All right, so we'll do, I think we have time for one more question. Okay, and I think this is one that has probably been rattling around in a bunch of noggins out there, and so I will go ahead and I'll put this one out there. Mita, we'll start with you since you were the last one, and we'll work our way back through. Under Alaska's top four system, multiple candidates with similar constituencies may reach the general election. If you advance but trail another ideologically similar candidate, what factors would determine whether you stay in the race or withdraw?
Ooh, good question. I'm independent, nonpartisan. So we have 14 Republicans, 2 independents, and 2 Democrats. They have to sort themselves out. And so as an independent coming into the race, I do have crossover in both parties, and there's 65% of Alaskans are independent, nonpartisan. So with a ranked choice 4, I would stay in, because if you like me, you're probably going to take somebody, if you're leaning Republican, maybe like Shelley, and rank her 2nd. And you'll be able to have those votes then tabulate until we get the winner. If you're more Democratic-leaning, you may choose somebody else. So I appreciate actually ranked choice voting, because your vote is not lost if your top pick doesn't get in.
Okay, and a follow-up to you, Mita, on that. Will you vote yes or no to keep or repeal ranked choice voting?
I will vote to keep ranked choice voting, and not only for itself. It also has provisions in there that makes people and campaigns disclose dark money. We have to know where the money comes from over anything.
Thank you. And Adam, on to you. Same question. Under the top four system in Alaska, multiple candidates with similar constituencies may reach the general election. If you advance but trail another ideologically similar candidate, what factors would determine whether you stay in the race or withdraw?
So to start with, I hate ranked choice voting, so you can guess how I'm going to vote. But with this system, it actually does make more sense for more conservatives to stay in it, because you actually work together. In 2022, what we had with Nick and Sarah was they fought and shot at each other for 6 months. We have actually done a very good job on this campaign of actually working together and pushing forward ideas. You actually increase the ceiling, and the math actually works out. I'm a numbers guy. Over time, it does work. I want to make sure that the seat is protected, and I think that actually the math works over time. But if we all come together and we say, you know what, we're dividing resources, that's a different conversation. But I think the best way to actually protect the seat, to get a Republican in there, is to actually keep it. And this is the last question?
Yes.
So you guys actually have a chance to vote here, too. And I just want to note that you get to write down a name. So remember, prosperity and change is on the ballot, and it's spelled Adam Crum.
Thank you. Follow-up to that, Adam. It sounds like you would be a no on keeping ranked choice voting. If that's the case, can you explain why? A no to keeping ranked choice voting. Oh, man, these ballot measures are so backwards. Yes, you would repeal ranked choice voting. Okay, all right. So there we go. Yes, you would repeal it.
I have been attuned to yes to end the mess. So yes on to in November. And it's because it actually got rid of the simplest thing, which is one person, one vote. We turn over the results to an algorithm. You cannot hand tabulate it. That is wrong. So that is why I want to get rid of that system and go back. And there is a reason why 14 other jurisdictions last cycle voted it down, including bright blue Oregon.
There you go. And Matt Halala, same thing to you. Do you need me to repeat the original question? Okay, I'll go ahead and I'll repeat that. Scrolling down my list of very lengthy questions until I find it again. Under Alaska's top four primary system, multiple candidates with similar constituencies may reach the general election. If you advance but trail another ideologically similar candidate, what factors would determine whether you stay in the race or withdraw?
Well, that's it's a great topic. About a year ago, I had the thought that I would immediately withdraw because we saw what happened with Sarah and Nick. But there are many other factors, such as if I have a meaningful path to victory, okay, that plays a role. If I don't have a meaningful path to victory, then I withdraw. The other is if there's an indictment, an October surprise, some kind of a shenanigan that the opposing party is going to play on the person that is 10 votes ahead of me and they're just waiting for me to leave, that's another factor where maybe we would all be best off staying in. So there's a lot of things to consider there, and it's a sad part of this ranked choice voting thing is that it's ripe for shenanigans because there are so many little factors like that that people – really hadn't thought about before.
And then same follow-up, yes or no on ballot measure two and why?
Yeah, yes on ballot measure two. I think that it's pretty evident that when you have to reteach the population how to vote every vote campaign cycle, it's a big fail. And we call it a triumph of technology over common sense. And it's just bad. It makes no sense. And I think it's very interesting. A state that overwhelmingly votes Republican in statewide elections was the target of this, not the blue states. They're doing just fine with regular, good old-fashioned voting.
All right, thank you.
That's a good time to say pick one primary, right? A lot of people are confused about that. Pick one in the primary. One person, one vote, one person.
In the primary, yes. Dave Bronson, to you, the same original question. Would you like me to read it again?
No, it's good.
Okay.
There's about 150 people in here. How many people in here completely understand ranked choice voting? Raise your hand. Okay, there's your problem. We've got maybe, 12 people that understand you can't have an election system that the people don't understand. I've got to ask questions. In certain scenarios in the November election, if this and this and this happens, what goes on? And I don't know, and I probably should know that. So the ranked choice voting system is a debacle in this state. Just get rid of it. Start over. Go back to the old. I'm old school. I'm 68. I like it. You know, when we voted the old way, we go down the fire hall, the local school, and vote. Afghanistan does this really well. They go in, look at an ID, they vote, they dip their thumb in purple ink, and they go like this, and the ink sticks for 2 weeks, and they can't vote again. And they have really good voter turnout and reliability. Afghanistan. So what's the next question?
Is there a condition in which you would withdraw if you were trailing?
Yeah, it depends on who I'm trailing, and I'm not going to make that decision until I get there. So both Adam and Matt made really good arguments as to why this is a really complex decision. The notion that I would stand up and say at this point in time, I'll absolutely get out if I'm number two on the Republican side, that's foolishness. So,
okay, thank you. And then finally, to Ms. Hughes.
So my commitment is to do whatever it takes, and if that includes pulling out, to ensure we don't have a liberal governor and have a conservative. Because if we have a liberal governor, we will have taxes, we will have mass exodus, and we will have a suppression of resource development, and I'm not okay with that. And I want to say, too, since we're winding up, I can beat the Democrat. I've had 6 elections. A recent one, it was a Libertarian, a Democrat, and me, and I still won by 78%. And let me say, Palmer has a city council controlled by Democrats. I can beat the Democrat. My ticket does not have skeletons. It does not have baggage. And we have high favorability. So we can beat the Democrat, and I would appreciate you walking into the voting booth, and when you do, to choose Hughes on August 18th. Thank you.
Thank you. A big round of applause, everyone, for all of our candidates here this evening.
And that'll be all for this week's episode of the Kenai Conversation. Find the full debate online at radiokenai.com. As a reminder, you can listen to the Kenai Conversation here on KDLL every Wednesday at 10 a.m. and Saturday at 5 p.m. You can also find the show on our website, kdll.org. I'm Ashlyn O'Hara. Thanks for listening.